Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 60 for May 23rd, 2008, PP number 1. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook and a whole lot more, visit audible.com/windows. It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott on deadline. This is going to be a very short Windows Weekly. I'm going to talk very fast, Paul, and you can talk fast too, and then we'll get over with in about half an hour, okay?
Yellow.
You're working on what?
Me?
Yeah. You're on deadline. You said you have a book to do or something.
Yeah, book thing.
That book thing. You forgot already?
I've been working on this one thing for the past 3 months, but I can't remember what it was.
Oh, books.
Oh, right.
Oh, books. It's the next version of Windows Vista Secrets.
Yeah.
You don't sound so thrilled. Paul, I'm giving you a chance to enthuse.
I know. I'm sorry. It's a good book. Actually, I have to say.
I love you. This is what I like about Paul. You know, he's not exactly, you know, Mr. Smiley, glad hander, you know.
It's a good book. You should really buy it.
If you want it, get it. It's okay. No, it is. It's the best Windows Vista book. I'm going to say that for you because it's true.
Yeah. So I've got 25 of 26 chapters in the can, as we say in the business. It's taken a long time. I've updated books before, and I've always gone into that thinking I'm only updating, I'm not writing. This will be quick.
Nope.
And it has not been quick. It's been a complete, it's been like writing another book.
It's never quick. And is that because, Service Pack 1 is such a big change?
No. No.
Why is it?
No. Why is that? Because I'm an idiot, Leo. Because I wanted to expand on what was available in the first volume, and some of that stuff obviously is related to Service Pack 1, but I've added things. I have a chapter on the Zune, for example, which doesn't come with Windows Vista, but is, I feel, an important platform, you know, for Microsoft going forward and related to Windows.
I think that's true. Yeah,
they have Windows Media and so forth. There's a new chapter on the live services. Well, actually, there was a short chapter about Windows Live previously, but it's been dramatically expanded. There's a new chapter that focuses on Windows Vista companion products like OneLive, OneCare Live, and Windows Live OneCare, jeez, and Windows Home Server, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, a year goes by and a lot changes. And one of the irritating things about the book is that even as I'm working on this revision, things are changing. You know, the new version of the Zune software came out literally right after I submitted the chapter. That sort of thing's been happening. So,
they're out to get you, Paul.
Books are not the most timely way to relay information about the computer industry, you know, when it comes down to it.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons computer books are kind of having a hard time, because the internet has so much information. But I still think a lot of people like to have it in paper form sitting on the desk in front of them while they're looking at the computer. I think there's a real market for that. You're right. It's not going to be the most timely. But it's up to date. It's everything.
One of the things, you know, I one of my pet peeves throughout life, and I've been working on writing books since 1993 or four, somewhere there.
Wow.
And I never wanted to be the guy that made that 1,000-page tome that, you know, if you fell asleep reading it, it would fall on your head and kill you. And unfortunately, this book is leaning a lot more in that direction than the previous edition.
1,000 pages? You think it'll be that long?
No. It's probably somewhere in the 800-page range somewhere, I guess. I don't actually. I just pulled that one right out of my butt. I don't know how long it is, but it's true. It's longer. It's
folks,
dramatic.
We're getting Paul at a stage in every book author's life. There is a point.
I'm just going to spontaneously start crying.
Yeah, usually it's right at the last chapter. The publisher's, you know, biting your butt. You're working as hard as you can. You're already exhausted from months of writing. And basically everything looks like crap.
Last night, this is so weird. I sat down at the table last night and everyone in my family kind of looked at me and I was like, what? And they said, well, we're discussing our days. How has your day been? And I said, I really don't want to talk about this right now. And my daughter said, come on, Dad. And I was like, my day stinks. Like, I woke up at 6:30 in the morning. I've been working on this book until I went to the gym. I came back. I worked on it all day. I worked on it until the second I sat down at this table. When I get up again, I'm going to go sit down in front of the computer and work on it again until 10 o'clock at night.
Oh.
And my kids are just looking at me with these, you know, wide eyes like,
Daddy's, what have Daddy's upset. Daddy's in a bad mood. Oh, Lord. But no, I know how you feel. I mean, I wrote a book or two in my time. And I, you know, in fact, the last one that I really wrote from page one to the end, because I soon learned that it's easier and better to have people who do this for a living do it because they're so good at it.
Sure.
But the last one I wrote beginning it, I had a spy cam on me and I have several thousand photos of me. And I would put, you know, 88 pages to go, 85 pages to go, 80 pages. And yes. it's a document that well still brings chills to my.
I have a table of contents that I taped to the wall, and it has several versions of it taped on top of old versions. Yeah. Where as chapters are completed, they're crossed off.
Right.
And I'm looking at it now, and there's one left.
It's kind of like a prisoner who's tallying the days. I feel for you, Paul. Yeah. But you know what? Thank you for what you do, and thank you for doing that work because it really is. I don't think computer books are far from dead, especially this kind of book, this reference guide, this 800-page reference guide. That's what people want and they need, and they're very useful. And I have it on my bookshelf, and I pull it out all the time. So, thank you.
It's good for kindling, you know. If you know, fuel prices are high, I'm just saying. You know, it may eventually be cheaper than buying gas.
I've been there. I've been there.
No, actually, but seriously, you know, picking this thing up a year and a half later or 2 years later, whatever it was, and looking at it again with fresh eyes, you know, I feel pretty good about it. You know, it's and then, you know, being able to expand it as much as I did, was nice.
So. It's a very good book, and I'm really glad. Yeah, you should put the Zune in it because that's part of the Windows experience for a lot of people. Well, a few dozen people anyway.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about Windows. Did you do an iPod chapter?
No.
You'd have been thrown out of the Guild of Windows Writers if you did that.
I did an XP digital media book where I threw in some iPod stuff. I mean,
certainly. You know, I was just looking at downloads, and iTunes on Windows is about 10 times bigger than iTunes on the Mac. I mean, a lot of people have iPods on Windows.
Of course, yeah.
It's nothing to be sneezed at.
Yeah.
Office, I want to talk about Microsoft Office 2007 a little bit because I think Microsoft's done the right thing. They've announced compatibility in file formats.
Yeah. You may be alone in that opinion, by the way. One thing I had talked to Microsoft about when they briefed me on this was, well, what do you think the reaction is going to be from the open source crazies? And they said, oh, come on, we're doing the right thing. You know, there's no way you could pick this thing apart. And sure enough,
really? You know,
since this announcement.
What's their complaint?
It's you know what? I sort of condescendingly broke it down to something like, you know, these guys say that they're for choice, but what they really want is for people not to choose Microsoft.
Right. I agree.
And as Microsoft makes it harder and harder to do that, their argument against using the Microsoft products get, you know, less and less believable.
No, that's true.
And so I think what's happening here is that now that Microsoft is opening up Office to open document formats and really opening up Office to these things, they're trying to, you know, well, you know, it's Microsoft. We can't trust them. You know, how can you believe they're going to do what they say they're going to do? You know, that kind of thing. Even the EU, who I increasingly am at odds with as far as antitrust stuff goes, you know, came out and said, well, we're investigating this. You know, we'll see if, you know, their promises live up to, you know, the reality, that kind of thing. And jeez.
So tell us what they did. They basically said that it's an open standard, the file format. Are they going to adhere to an existing standard?
No, I would say the way I would put it is in the past, Microsoft, one of the ways Microsoft would compete was that they owned these Office document formats. They were proprietary.
Yeah, and they made it very hard to reverse engineer.
Right. So if people like Corel with WordPerfect or, you know, open source projects like OpenOffice.org wanted to work with Microsoft Doc format or whatever, they would have to reverse engineer it. You know, over time, what Microsoft has come to understand is that what makes Office great is Office. You know, Office 2007 has a fairly innovative user interface and unique capabilities and so forth. And that's one of the ways that they can compete. But on the document format side, what they've heard from governments, especially local and national governments, is that these, you know, entities are worried about data retention and they want open formats that they know are always going to be available, you know, that they're not going to get locked into some vendor's solution and then, you know, be screwed 100 years down the road or whatever it is. So on one end, you know, Microsoft has obviously tried to make its own document formats open standards, and they've had some success there. ECMA and ISO, more controversially, have, you know, adopted Microsoft's OpenXML document formats as standards. But there are other open document formats out there that Microsoft competes with. So they've basically thrown in the towel on the competition side and said, well, we're still going to work on OpenXML. In fact, they're going to work with the ISO on the on whatever working group is, you know, developing future versions of that format. But they're also going to work with such things as the Open Document Format, ODF.
Good.
The PDF.
Good.
And their own XML paper specification, in addition to OpenXML. And the way they're going to deliver that compatibility is through Office 2007 Service Pack 2, which obviously would be a free upgrade. It will allow you to use something like ODF as the native default document format. Just
that's
like you can
important
change,
too, to be able to set it as the default so that people use it.
Yeah, it's, this is not import-export,
yeah,
right? It's,
yeah.
This will be the native format. If you want to use ODF, ODF is will be one of the choices. It will be right there with doc format. So, I think that's a big deal. They're also doing some side-related projects, like, you know, working with the various working groups and so forth in the open standards community on all of these formats. They're going to be part of the ODF working group, and they're going to work on future versions of PDF and future versions of XPS and future versions of OpenXML. So they're committed to this sort of interoperability because they know that that's what their customers want. And, you know, I would say at this stage, the document format is no longer the point of competition, I guess.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. The idea of that, that when you send out a document, I'd get a .doc file and I go, oh man. And I'd see things like, I'll give you an example of the committee. It's our little town of Petaluma, you know, advisory committee is sending out documents as .doc files. It's a proprietary format. And what they're essentially saying, or have been up to now, is you have to buy Office. You don't own Microsoft Office? And I keep trying to explain to them, no, not everybody does. You should do it it's okay to use Microsoft's RTF because everything can read it. But please don't send out doc files. That's assuming everybody owns Office.
Right.
But ODF is, of course, now .doc. I mean, Open Office reads it. Everything reads it. But it was a long haul to get it interpreted.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, am I wrong or...
No, you're right.
Okay. I don't understand.
You are, right. You are correct, sir.
Thank you. I don't understand how anybody could complain about that.
I don't either, but they're out there.
Oh, you know? Okay. And maybe it's not just not the perfect. Maybe the, I don't know. I can't. I'm not going
to. You can imagine. You know, Oasis has been asking Microsoft to join for years. And so this, now they've agreed to do so. And now I can only imagine what's going on over there is a bunch of guys going, whoa, 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 but wait, you're actually joining?
Hold on. So what about OOXML? Because that's the other Open Office's format. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be not till the next version, though, right?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of interesting. So they mentioned Office 14, which is the next version of Office, the version after Office 2007. They haven't said yet when that version will ship, probably in 2010. But it won't be until Office 14 that Microsoft supports the open standards version of its own OpenXML.
Isn't that funny?
format, yeah. But that's also very interesting because, you know, these other formats, you know, ODF, PDF, and XPS are all available today, right? So presumably the open version of OpenXML is coming down the road anyway. So
and it's almost obsolete now because of ODF.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, ODF is very specific, I believe, around like word processing documents only, right?
Oh, I get it.
OpenXML has, there are versions for presentation as spreadsheets.
Okay, that makes sense. I just wish there were one standard, you know, and one sure. non-proprietary open standard. I think some of this is because the government wants that too, right? I mean, some of this is to just...
This is absolutely because enough governments went to them and said, look, yeah. we really want to use Office, but we also really want to ensure that, you know, we have an open format. And I think there was some indecision about whether or not OpenXML was ever going to make it as a, you know, ratified standard. So they can support... They basically just opened up and said, look, we're going to interoperate with any open standard that makes sense and is popular. So, you know, PDF, ODF, whatever.
Yeah, and PDF isn't by any means an open standard, but I think it's such a generally used standard. I think it's great. Is like Microsoft had its own version of PDF. Did they give up on that? What did they call it? I forgot.
Oh, your XPS. No, that's part of this.
Okay.
No, they're still going ahead with that.
Okay. That's the problem is this profusion of standards makes it worse.
I remember years ago, I don't remember the context of the conversation, but I talked to somebody at Microsoft about PDF, and they were saying that they had actually figured out a way to, you know, write to PDF, and they could use PDF natively, but that they knew Adobe would sue them if they did it.
Oh.
And, they weren't, I can't remember what the, it must have been Office, I don't remember what the point of this was, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago that there were real concerns about interoperating with PDF, and obviously today those concerns are over. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't even know that, but that makes sense. Yeah, really, PDF really isn't an open standard. It's Adobe's standard.
Well, I think that, you know, obviously Apple is using PDF technologies in Mac OS X very extensively and in a very integrated fashion, and I think that's removed any barriers. You know, if Microsoft wanted to use PDF and Adobe complained, you know, they could say, but look at this, right. you know, right. look what they're doing.
Right. How about that Windows home server, huh? Power okay. Pack 1 on the way. What is Power Pack?
I love my Windows home server.
I know you do.
I want to be very clear about that.
The bloom is not off the rose for you.
No, this has been critical. And by the way, within the context of the book, you know, that I've been working on, there are three things that have emerged this year, you know, as things that were not available the first time I worked on the book. That have been crucial this time around. And one of them is Windows Home Server. One of them is Windows Live SkyDrive for backup purposes. And one is Live Mesh for data synchronization. Actually, I'd add SyncToy to that as well, actually. Mm-hmm. I've been using SyncToy mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these things all give me different ways to, you know, back this stuff up in different physical places, on different physical machines. Very seamlessly. It's been really wonderful. So, I mean, I don't use Home Server directly. I don't think anybody does, but it sits there.
Use the HP media, whatever it is.
Yeah. The Media Smart Server. Yeah. Smart. I love it.
Yeah. Hey, it's I want to give props. Can I give props to HP? Cause I slam them a lot.
Do you?
I do. I tell people not to get an HP PC cause of all the crap wear on it. You know, that's I mean, it's, you know, it's I mean, just, that crap. It's just loaded with this adware. But yep. my Auntie Dawn was here. She called me. She's about 80. And she called me. Mm-hmm. She said, I am getting porno pop-ups on wow. my PC. And I said,
yet
Dawn.
Another reason that Windows is so much better than that.
You wild woman, you. And so I said, we talked to her. I said, you got spyware. Bring it up and we'll take a look. She had spent $100. Because she knew it came from the internet, she'd called her internet service provider. And spent $100 with them, and they were completely useless. So right. it was a mess. So she brought it up. I booted it. It was like it wasn't booting. But HP has this recovery mode that I didn't know about. And I said next time call HP because they would have known about this. That it recovers it without deleting any data. It completely restored the system back to the original Service Pack 2 state. Mm-hmm. It did a great job. I'm scanning it right now with ESET Smart Security. There's not a bug left. And yet all her data and all her applications are intact. So I was really impressed. Yeah, I've been slamming you, HP. I apologize.
No, I had never really thought of it in this context. But, you know, my desktop PC that I use every day is an HP, as is my, I think this is, 24-inch display. My laptop sitting over here is an HP.
It's right. You like them.
Yeah.
I don't like all that crapware. And sometimes I feel like they don't do the it's not the best hardware in the world. And yet, I have to say... For especially a novice home user, the ability to kind of roll it back to without having to do this recovery where you delete everything, to roll right. it back to just the OS was fixed and it's working beautifully. I was really impressed. And of course, I immediately uninstalled the crapware. I said, are you playing Bingo Bango Bongo, the home version? And she said, no. I understand. You know, there's all these games, AOL, all this stuff.
Yeah, I'll have to look this up. I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, but there's an awesome free online utility you can download that is designed specifically
crap remover
to remove crap. Yeah.
Is it crap remover? I think it is.
No, decrapifier or something like that.
That's it. You got it.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. I should run that on this. Because I think it was for an HP he wrote it originally, although now it works cross-platform.
Well, the HP home server guys are really serious about this product. And I'm tempted to get one.
You love it so much.
I love it. I mean, I sort of accept that it's a niche-y kind of thing. It's a tough sell because I think a lot of people don't understand immediately why they need it or want it.
Right.
And I don't know, but it just combines a lot of stuff into one place, and it's just hugely valuable, and I love it.
He loves his home server. So will this power pack do to it? Is it going to fix that data corruption issue?
Yeah, so that will be part of it, although that's a more recent addition. You know, the original vision, as such as it is for the power pack one, is just a bunch of additional functionality. It's going to enable X64 clients. Right now, you can't run the home server console software on 64-bit Vista clients, and PP1 will add that. It's going to add the ability to back up the home server data.
They may not like you to call it PP1. Just a thought, marketing wise.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Definitely don't call it PP number one. They're really not going to like that. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. I'm just contemplating that. Okay, so
what else does it do?
Yeah, well, so the servers is one of the nice bits of functionality from server is it operates as a backup of your PCs, right?
Oh, neat. Yeah,
but it's also a data store, and it has data redundancy, so you can make sure that certain files you copy to the server are duplicated on two different physical hard disks, so that if there's a hard disk failure, there's some redundancy there, and you won't lose your files.
Is it doing that with RAID 5, or is it doing something else?
No, completely different technology.
Okay.
Which, by the way, might be part of that data corruption bug problem you mentioned earlier, but let's not go there right now.
Okay.
You're going to be able to back up that stuff off the server. There's some changes to remote access. There's some changes to the web view stuff. If you go in via the website, you get a secure website with each home server. You can view the files that are on the server. Right now, it's kind of a list view. So they've added some nicer views if you're looking at pictures and videos and so forth. And I think that's about it. Let me see. Yeah, so that's most of it. And obviously the data corruption issue that you mentioned earlier will also be fixed as part of that. Yeah. So there's actually a public beta starting very soon, or early June. You can sign up for it at connect.microsoft.com. So if you have Windows Home Server and you want to check out the first power pack, the beta will be available very soon. And then I think the final version probably by the end of the summer, around that time frame.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent, in fact. I'm very happy to hear that. How about, speaking of media and servers, I know you, in fact, I'm looking at right now, you're at the super site for Windows. You're talking about
what have I done?
The D-Link, the media extender. We've talked about media extenders before.
Yep.
So you're reviewing the D-Link?
Yeah. So I would say since January or so, I've been hoping to write a review about Vista era media center extenders. I had two Linksys boxes come through here earlier this year, one with an integrated DVD drive, one without. And both of them were absolutely horrible. In fact, so bad that I was really nervous about reviewing this because I feel like the extender concept is a good one. It worked well enough with the Windows XP era hardware, you know, within the confines of what was, you know, possible at the time. But these things seem like a bit of a step back. So I've been waiting on this D-Link, which I've been told is far superior to the Linksys version, but they've been delayed again and again. And the thing finally arrived about a week ago. And I have to say, it's actually pretty good. It looks a lot like the first generation extenders. It's a big pizza box. No moving parts. You know, you connect over your home network, either N wireless, G wireless, or Ethernet. And it basically just transmits the media center interface to your TV and you keep all your content on your computer, access it over the home network, and you can have it come out over the of the TV, like you might do with the Apple TV, let's say. And, you know, I have to say, not bad. It's not bad. And it works with CineWarrior movie content now, which is new to this week, actually. And the other thing that occurred that is related is Napster went MP3 this week.
I love this. They say they have 6 million songs.
6 million tracks, yeah. So they're now the largest DRM-free MP3 store available.
iTunes only has 2 million unprotected songs.
Well, they're not even MP3, though, right?
Oh, that's right. They're AAC. You're right. You're right.
Amazon, I want to say 4 million.
And I love Amazon, but these are just like the Amazons. 256 kilobit, high quality, no copy.
Yeah, same files. Bigger selection. You know, Napster doesn't have the greatest user interface in the world. In fact, I think when the history is written of what went wrong with Windows Media with regards to iTunes and the iPod and those things winning out, part of that story is going to be that Napster, which was the first major league Windows Media-oriented online music service, just completely botched it with a horrible user interface. they still are really screwing it up. But anyway, yeah. it's available through a web browser now. You don't have to download the software anymore. So anyone can use this. So if you have an iPod, you could browse up to the web in any web browser, download the songs that way, you know, push them into iTunes and get them on your iPod.
That's one thing I like about Amazon is that it has the downloader, which automatically pushed it into iTunes. Does this do the same thing?
I don't know. I haven't bought anything with it. I still have a sort of a natural reaction to
it. I know. Isn't that funny? Me too. It's like,
I'll get there. But I really like the way Amazon does it. I think they could improve browsability or whatever on the store.
Look, you know, that's the problem is that iTunes, it just has this great UI. They've got they solve the problem from beginning to the end.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big advantage of iTunes right now is that the selection is humongous.
Right.
They don't have, you know, most of it's protected, right?
Right.
But they do have this, you know, the TVs, movies, podcasts. I mean, they give it all kinds of stuff up there. It's all pretty seamless. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing we need to figure out in the Windows side.
I agree with you. I mean, that's a big advantage.
Yeah.
So the D-Link Media Extender, Napster MP3, I'm just looking down the list. I wanted to ask you about Feature Pack 2008, Fiji, they call it, for the Media Center.
Right, the Media Center update, yeah. So one of the weird things about Windows Vista is that the version of Windows Media Center that shipped in that product is only half complete. And if you look at it side by side with the XP version, a lot of the screens that you see first, and the now playing type screens where a video is playing full screen and so forth, are brand new. You know, they're very attractive. But a lot of the sub-screens are basically the version from XP with the lighter blue color scheme applied to them.
Right.
And the thinking at the time was, you know, obviously Vista's going to ship when it's going to ship, and we're not done, so we'll update it in the future. And at that time, to that date, the Media Center guys had released an update every year, probably for 4 or 5 years in a row, or whatever that was. And then the last holiday season came and went, and there was no Media Center update. Fiji is the code name of the version that was supposed to ship last year. At one point, it was going to be part of Service Pack 1. You know, Microsoft's been unsure about how or when they were going to ship this thing. And I've heard from the guys on the Zune team that the people responsible for the Media Center user interface actually took almost a year off from Media Center to work on the Zune 2 software, so that UI you're seeing there is you know, coming from those same guys.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Well, now a year later, they're firing up the beta again. So the Fiji version of Media Center is going to be called Windows Media Center Feature Pack 2008. It's not clear exactly how they're going to ship it, but I'm thinking it's going to be a free download. I can't imagine them charging anyone for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unclear right now what the new features are going to be. I do know in looking at Windows 7, you know, the next major version of Windows, which has a major new update to Windows Media Center, that I haven't seen that level of change yet in the beta. So I'm curious, you know, to see how it changes over time. But as far as the first beta that just went out, it looks very much like the old version that's in Windows Vista. So
explain to me, if I had Media Center 2005, would this update that as well?
No, it's only for Windows Vista.
It's only for Vista. Okay.
Yeah, and Media Center is only available in Windows Vista Home Premium and in Ultimate Edition.
Okay.
You know, previously, obviously, in XP, you had to have Media Center Edition.
Right.
To get the software.
Yeah, but basically everybody with a higher-end version of Vista now has that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And you actually, have to start it. I haven't started it. You know why I haven't started it?
You have to start it.
You have to install. You have to run this little thing. It doesn't just, you know, happen. But then it says, okay, but in order to do that, you have to install the Intel Vive software. And I've been kind of reluctant to install the Intel Vive software.
I've not. I don't know.
I just because I have a Vive PC.
No, I'm sorry. You haven't lived until you've
You know that VIV thing?
My HP is a Vive or whatever that is as well. But of course, I wipe it out and put my own stuff on there.
Right.
All I don't think that went anywhere, did it? the Vive thing.
Vive, no. Can. But then, see, I don't know if that's why I don't want to, like, I don't even know what it means to install it. I thought my system runs fine. What do you mean Vive? I have to install Vive, and now I can install Media Center?
Your computer is going to come alive.
With Vive?
Vive.
So the Fiji update is out when?
By the end of the year.
Okay. You can get it in beta soon?
Yeah, right now it's a private beta, I would hope. And expect that they would release some sort of a public beta. But I haven't heard yet on that. I hope that that's what happens. I mean, one thing these guys desperately need is a little bit of feedback, you know,
right.
They've been kind of operating in their own little bubble for a while. And I just think Media Center is a feature that's kind of teetering on the edge. It was so excellent when it first came out and so leading edge. And it has now been so ignored over several product versions that it's too bad, because compared to things like TiVo or any other DVR type solutions, it's really kind of a neat interface and it works really well. I mean, there's been some controversy about that broadcast flag protection technology and so forth, but Media Center is pretty nice. And again, you can get it out in your living room using an extender. It's not too shabby, but I don't know. I just feel like it's maybe its time is kind of come and gone. It's unclear.
Yeah. You are working in Google Docs these days.
A little bit.
It's not like I can tell. I mean, it's not like everything that you...
Everything is misspelled now. Yeah. Well, actually, it's a problem. Obviously, I use Microsoft Word all the time. And what happens over time is you come to rely on it. So I'll occasionally have people who will write me and say, hey, I just looked at this article you wrote and you've got this weird misspelling or, whatever it might be. And I always think, why didn't Word catch that? But I wonder if I haven't become less effective as a writer because I rely on these automated tools.
Right.
Yeah. I can type poorly because I know it will correct as I type.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know about you, but I know my kids are that way.
Yeah.
They'll say, I didn't see any spell checking errors. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And God forbid you ever actually have to write anything by hand. Do you ever do this?
Yeah.
I am suddenly a cripple. 10 seconds into it, my hand starts cramping
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
I can't even sign checks.
I'm like the elephant man.
Actually, why am I writing checks? It's 2008. But you get the idea.
Right. Exactly. My handwriting, I look like a 4-year-old. It's terrible.
Yeah. My handwriting, you can see it deteriorating over the course of just a few sentences.
That's funny.
Anyway, Google Docs, obviously, can't hold a candle to Microsoft Word when it comes to, the quality of the tools, the presentation and all that stuff. But it's also really free and it's available online and they have offline features and they've been improving the experience a lot. I mean, they've added some things just to kind of make it look almost like an old fashioned version of Word. It has a menu and a toolbar and all that stuff. But a few of my recent articles, including some that aren't up yet, Firefox 3 review, I've written an article about Windows XP Service Pack 3 that I haven't posted yet.
Don't write a review of Microsoft Office in Google Docs.
Yeah, actually, why not?
Go ahead. Live it up.
Yeah, so this is kind of weird.
Are you doing this as an experiment, or is this actually something you think you might do in going forward? That's kind of, I always feel like I'm suffering a little bit when I use these online word processors.
Yeah. So in other words, as a writer, you might think that I must use all these crazy features in Word, but the truth is I only use a teeny percentage of the available functionality in Word. So I would say that The only thing, well, okay, first of all, the spelling and grammar checking, I don't even know if there is grammar checking. Actually, I don't think there is. The spell checking that's available in Google Docs is not as good,
right,
as in Word. It's not even close. I don't believe there is grammar checking at all, so that's obviously an issue. So that stuff is a little bit of a problem. Although I have to say, there's part of me that thinks not having good spell checking isn't such a horrible thing because it's forcing me to actually pay attention.
Right.
And maybe I should be paying attention.
See, I don't notice it because I mostly use Macs, and Mac, the spell checking is system-wide.
It's right. Okay. So actually, that's a good point. I wonder if a lot of the... No, it's built in. I was, you know, Firefox has built-in spell checking too, but I think that's only for forums. So I think this is interesting, and I think this would solve a lot of people's needs, to be honest. I really do, especially when you can use it offline, right? And that's going to get better and better over time. And one of the things that's going to happen in the future, you can kind of play with it today with technologies like Mozilla Prism or things like that, is you're going to be able to sort of turn these things into mini applications. So you'll have a shortcut on your desktop that will look like a normal shortcut. Right. And you'll run this thing, and what you're really doing is running Google Docs over the internet. But what it looks like is a local application. And I think when you have that blurring of the line, when that occurs, and when these things are powerful enough, I don't think people are going to care. You know, I would never use something like Microsoft Works, for example. I just don't see the point. So the thing that makes this compelling to me mostly is that it's a web service. And I recognize that it's going to improve over time, but it's not like using it is painful. I mean, it works great.
Well, in some ways it's simpler. I know a lot of writers just say, I don't want all those features. And it's really just a white screen. You start typing.
Yeah. Well, by the way, one of the things, if you haven't done this, this is actually really cool. In Office 2007 and in specifically in Word 2007, which is where I do this a lot of the time, one of the things you can do is double click on the tab headings above the ribbon. And when you do that, the ribbon actually disappears.
Oh, I like that.
So what you're left with is an application window that very much looks like Microsoft Notepad, but you've got the full power of Word in there. And as you click on the tabs that are left up there at the top, it looks like a menu bar. The ribbon comes down temporarily. You can access that functionality. And then when you mouse back away from it, it goes away. So, you do have that, Word can be a big, confusing application, and all of Office obviously can be big and confusing. But I think one of the nice things about Office 2007, at least in the ribbonified applications, is you can hide that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is something pretty clean. But
well, that was
anyway,
the whole point of the ribbon. The whole point of the ribbon was to get all of that elaborate user interface stuff out of the way and make it easier to find what you want, right?
Yeah, I think I would put it the big point was discoverability. Yes. I think that I don't know the exact numbers, but in talking to the guys from the Office team, one of the things they'll always say is, you know, we would do these customer feedback sessions where we'd say, you know, what would you like to see in the next version of Office? And 7 out of the top 10 requests were features that had been in there for years, but you know, people never knew where to find them. So one of the goals of the ribbon was to expose functionality, you know, in a way that was logical, and I think it's been pretty successful.
No, I like Google Docs. You know what I use the spreadsheet for? And it actually, this is where I find it useful. We keep information about what the Audible book picks are in the spreadsheet. So, mm-hmm. And then I can share it with the agency and with Audible so they know what our picks are the minute I type it in. And so I think the sharing ability is...
Sharing is cool. You know, one of the things... I don't have a lot of opportunity to do that, although I could see that changing. One of the things I have to do, and this is true both at the magazine with the various newsletters and also the print articles I write, and then again with the book, is we use Word's revisioning feature very extensively.
Oh, yeah. You got to have that.
You got to have that. And that's been one of those issues with backwards compatibility and document compatibility that, you know, the OpenOffice.org guys have run into issues with. And it's hard, you know, making that work. And I wouldn't want to use a product like OpenOffice and have other people I was working with using Word and hoping that these things worked as you move back and forth. I haven't tested it. I don't know for sure, but I don't believe that Google Docs supports this sort of functionality. And I think for it to be taken seriously, it will have to eventually, you know, offer that.
Yeah. Revisioning is tough. Yeah.
Yeah. It supports revision. I mean, it supports the notion of document versions, you know, revisions, I think they call them, but
it's a really nice feature to be able to say, oh, I think this should be different. You know, it's funny, the Adobe Flash word processor, Buzzword, at least has the ability to put a note in there, like a little post-it note. I haven't played enough with it to know, but anyway, with Google Docs to know what it does in that regard. But I think you're right.
Obviously I'm a Microsoft guy and, you know, I write, so I'm going to use Word, but I think that for a lot of people, especially students, and I always think how awesome it would be to be going through school now, you know, with all
everything's free. Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. It's all free.
I wouldn't pay for anything. You wouldn't have to, you know?
No.
No, not because I was stealing it. I mean, because
you
know, it's,
you did love Napster, didn't you?
As that one sort of settled in. You know, no, I mean, it would be, there's so much of this stuff. It's just astonishing.
I know exactly what you're saying. Hey, let's do our Audible pick, and then I want to get a software pick for you from you and a tip, and then I'll let you get back to chapter 4,733.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah. That it does, of Windows Vista Secrets. Okay. So Audible is, of course, our sponsor, and this is the time we take every show to talk about Audible books. Audible online downloads allow you to listen to any of 45,000 incredible titles, some of the best stuff you've ever heard. Audible.com/Windows is a place to go to get a free book. If you're not already an Audible member, I just want to give you a little pitch. Audible has saved my life many a time, I tell you. If I've got a long drive or commute, for 8 years I commuted to San Francisco and it saved my life. And it's so good. So many great books. Paul and I both are big Audible listeners. What you said you had some recommendations. Well, first of all, we want to mention there's a half price sale, right?
Yeah. And actually, a lot of the books that we've recommended in the past are in this sale. You know, The 4-Hour Workweek was in there. Charlie Wilson's War was in there.
Right.
Fahrenheit 451 was in there. So that's, if you're already on Audible, you should check that out.
Half price, just right at the top of the page. I think it's only on for a little bit longer, so take advantage of that. Now, if you're not yet a member, go to audible.com/windows and get a free book. And you have something you want to recommend?
Yeah, I actually described two different things, and they're completely different types of books, so I'll just mention both of them. And neither one of them is particularly new. One was, and both of them are actually books that I had started reading and never finished.
Mm-hmm.
And it was weird. I ran into both of them on Audible site recently. I said, this is how I'm going to finish this. One is a Stephen King series of four short stories called The Man in the Black Suit.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Yeah, well, it's actually four stories from the book that's called Everything's Eventual. And other parts of that book are actually available in other Audible book collections. But this particular one has four of the stories. And it's called Man in the Black Suit, Four Dark Tales, you know, by Stephen King. I also noticed that he has a new one out that came out just a month ago called The Gingerbread Girl. And I didn't grab that one yet. I probably will in the future. It looks like it's related to I don't know if you read or listened to Duma Key.
Yeah, that's the new one. You recommended it. I haven't listened to it yet.
That book's great. But if you look at the description of Gingerbread Girl, it looks like it takes place in exactly the same place.
Oh, interesting. So it's almost like a follow-up.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that.
He is so prolific. Do you think he ever has days where he goes, I got one more chapter. I can't take it.
Probably I actually, obviously, I mean, he's used pen names and has tried to retire and can't, and has, you know.
He writes so much that he has to use a pen name, otherwise people won't believe he wrote it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I think Stephen King is woefully underrated as a writer.
No, we've had this conversation before. He's unfortunately pigeonholed as a genre writer, and he's so good that it's a shame. I mean, he's much more than just a horror writer. He is one of our best novelists.
And it's what's amazing is he's written some of the best short stories I've ever read, but he's also written some of the most epically long books I've ever read, like complete version of The Stand, 1600 just long or whatever.
I love that, though.
And it's still one of those books where you're reading it and you just don't want it to end. You know, it's so well written, and you have to wonder how this guy keeps track of all the various storylines.
Sure, he has charts on the wall, don't you think?
I mean, I couldn't possibly.
He's not using Google Docs.
No, he's not.
No. You couldn't fit the stand in a Google Doc. I wish they had the stand in an audiobook. It'd be, 800 hours.
Not to get back on Google Docs, but one of the limitations of Google Docs, because I tried to import a bunch of documents, is they have document size limitations. And a lot of the book chapters, I could not back them up to Google Docs, but I could back them up to SkyDrive and to Office Live Workspace, no problem. But Google Docs
really
would not accept them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Apparently, they're being a little stingy with the storage over there.
They're too big, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to put in a word with Audible to get Stephen King's The Stand, but until then, because I would.
Can you imagine how long would that be? It would be like experiencing it in real time.
It would be. It'd be great. You know,
and 17 weeks.
I like long audiobooks because you get immersed in the world.
Yeah.
And you don't. And that you're right. You don't want them to end. And even more so with an audiobook, because when you're listening to audiobooks, until you've done this, you've got to listen to one of these books because it's a visceral experience. You're really in it, especially with a good reader. Much more so that I find than I feel when I'm
the reader really makes a difference. By the way, I don't maybe dumping on an audiobook isn't the right thing to do at this time, but have you ever read the Anne McCaffrey Dragon books? Like
no, Dragon Riders of Pern. Yeah.
No, so when I was growing up, I went through a huge phase of Larry Niven, Isaac Asimov,
the best.
And so I read a bunch of these books and the Dragon Riders of Pern books. And I noticed they have the second and third of the original trilogy on Audible, but not the first for some reason. But they're read by Adrian Barbeau.
Oh, no.
And oh, man.
Oh, no.
They're really bad.
Okay. Like the Dragon Rider. Oh, my God. He was amazing.
This actually triggered an Amazon Kindle purchase because I wanted to see if these books, have held up. So I grabbed the first one on the Kindle for like $5, which is pretty reasonable. But I can't.
Adrian Barbeau, no.
Not so
but
good.
You know what? You know what? Now they've changed it. Meredith McCray is reading the newest, the new one.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now Adrian Barbeau has read many of the Dragon Rider, the Pern books. She has, if you go through
the
list.
What's the best one? What one should I read?
If you're going to read any of them?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Let me wait a week because I'm going to go read it on the Kindle.
They have a ton of these.
Sometimes you go back to something that you really enjoyed growing up. And
yeah,
it's
they don't.
Horrible.
Yeah.
So let me read
Dragon
this
Drums is read by Adrian Barbeau. And Dragon Quest.
The White Dragon is number two. I want to say Dragonfall is number three.
You know who I blame, though? The publisher. Sometimes what Audible has is the one that you'd buy on the shelf, at the store. And usually the publishers try to get celebrities to read these. Like I see that they've got Meredith McCray, Lee Merriweather. They've got
Merriweather.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Well, obviously Anne McCaffrey, a woman science fiction writer, pretty unusual, especially back in the 60s through 80s when she was really at the top of her game or whatever. So they have women celebrities of the day.
But not all of these are. And Meredith McCray might do a very good job. I see some of them are read by others. Yeah. You know what? Let's find Sally Darling reads a number of them.
If you want to, the quintessential kind of voice for like a serious book is look up State of Denial, that Bob Woodward book, and just play the sample. And that's the voice you're looking for right there.
Well, let's listen. I like Brits. I like it when Brits read them.
Obviously Stephen Fry doing a Douglas Adams book is
there's nothing better.
The perfect storm of
there's
comedy.
Better. But, yeah. This is a guy named Boyd Gaines reads this. So you think this guy's the best, huh? Let me see.
He just has the right kind of voice.
I have to push some buttons. See what's wrong. Oh yeah.
Computers,
they never understand them. Is he reading?
After all, his father had strong feelings. Is this a trap door?
Oh, I've heard this guy.
Yeah, doesn't he sound instantly familiar?
Yeah. I've heard a lot of his reading. Yeah.
Yeah. This guy sounds very familiar.
Oh, he's good. State of Denial. That's another good one. Oh, well, we got too many recommendations.
I think it's about 17 books right there.
Pick one. I think the new Stephen King books, are they short stories? Are they novellas?
Stephen King is four short stories. You got to remember, it's Memorial Day weekend. This is the start of the summer reading set. Different people have different tastes, obviously, but I think any of this stuff,
No, I do that with Audible. I will load up, if I know I'm going on a trip or it's summertime, I'll load up a bunch of books.
We go to a local beach every afternoon during the summer.
Oh, man.
And obviously this year I have the Kindle, so I'll probably be destroying it with sand, but
bring an audiobook. You don't have to sit, you don't have to read in the sun.
That was the point. I mean, the Kindle has, Audible.
You can listen on it. Oh, yeah, I forgot. You can listen to Audible. Yeah. Audible plays on a variety of devices, including all the iPods. As you said, the Zune's coming soon. audible.com/windows. Get your Audible book right now. We thank Audible so much for their support. And don't forget that half price sale is almost running out. All right, that's it for Audible. Time for our tip of the week. You got a good Vista tip for us from the book? Something from the book, maybe?
Yes. Another reading from the book of Windows Vista.
From a good book.
This is from chapter 3, Leo.
Oh, my favorite.
It's called Hardware and Software Compatibility. But the tip is really about the Windows Vista Upgrade Advisor. This is something I had to revisit, obviously, because I'm writing the book, and it's one of those things I haven't really looked at recently, but it's kind of funny. If you haven't used this tool in a while, I do recommend it, if only for the comedy value. And it's good to use on the oldest possible computer you can find.
Okay.
Because my suspicion is, no matter what computer you use, it will tell you that it is capable of running Windows Vista. But the thing that's interesting about the tool, and the thing that's valuable about the tool, is it looks at your hardware, the innate hardware of the system, the motherboard, the CPU, the graphics hardware, et cetera. It looks at any devices that you have connected to the system, and it looks at all the software applications that you have installed, and it will tell you what your upgrade experience is going to be like. It will tell you the things that don't meet the minimum requirements. It will tell you the things that aren't compatible. It will tell you the things that you might want to upgrade after you upgrade to Windows Vista, the software that you might have to look for new drivers for hardware or new versions of the software, et cetera. So it's actually pretty valuable. And I think the thing that's interesting about the Upgrade Advisor is it's running off of that same backend database that they use for Windows Update and for automatic updates. So it's always up to date. So if you ran if you ran the Upgrade Advisor a year ago and then ran it again today against the same hardware, you would actually get different results because the hardware and software compatibility issues have actually improved pretty dramatically
over
the past year.
Yeah.
So I try to look around for something, an older XP system. And the truth is I get rid of hardware pretty quickly around here. So I didn't have much, but I do have a 3.5-year-old IBM ThinkPad, single core CPU, 512 megs of RAM, some kind of a small hard drive. And sure enough, I was told that, Windows Vista would be A-okay on the system, although it did then recommend upgrading the graphics processor, which is not possible.
Depends what you mean by A-okay.
Yeah, well, they do want you to buy Windows Vista. but I was surprised. One of the things I had seen a year ago when I first looked at this tool was that it almost always recommended Ultimate Edition too, which I thought was funny. Yeah, but this time it said, maybe Business Edition would be
really
enough.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Oh,
it is kind of a low end system.
Runs better with Ultimate.
If what doesn't? So and plus you get the Dreamscape stuff. So now. The URL to find this thing is really long, so I did one of those tiny URL URLs.
Good. Yeah.
So it's tinyurl.com/3b27j6.
Okay.
That's the whole thing.
tinyurl3b27j6. But we'll put this in the show notes.
There you go.
So this is the same one that I've been recommending to people before Vista came out.
Right.
But now updated.
It has a dual, there's a dual use thing here. Primarily, the point of this would be you've got an XP-based PC. You want to see if the thing can run Vista. And if so, whether or not you need to make any changes.
Right.
It actually does a good job at that. They also use it for a bit of marketing. So you can run the thing under Windows Vista. And if you have, it doesn't matter what version of Windows Vista you have. So if you have Windows Vista Home Basic, I can assure you, it will recommend upgrading to Windows Vista Ultimate.
Well, there isn't. I mean, okay, yeah. My advice to you is upgrade. That's what the upgrade advisor says.
We have examined your system, and in our opinion,
you should upgrade.
You would be best served by what happens to be coincidentally the most expensive version of Windows Vista. You know, click here to upgrade.
But you're saying it is useful for hardware, for software issues.
It's actually very good at that kind of stuff because, you know, like I said, it uses that database that Microsoft uses to determine,
what
to deliver to you for upgrades. You know, so it tells you. And on the ThinkPad, I printed the thing out. It was a great list of, you know, these are the drivers you're going to have to go find. Right. You know, here are the things you're going to have to make. We recommend upgrading the RAM, which obviously on a 512 meg system would be.
What do they suggest going to? A gig?
For RAM?
Yeah.
I don't think they actually made a specific recommendation. Their recommended minimum RAM is a gig. The actual minimum is 512 meg, although you'd be crazy to run Vista on 512. But my opinion is that you should have 2 gigs of RAM.
Yes, right. Well, your opinion is right.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's fantasy land, and then there's reality.
Reality land. And then there's Epcot, which nobody likes.
You know, 512 megs in Vista.
Not going to work. God love you.
I'm
not going to work with anything. You got a software pick for us today?
I do. I have two, just because there's a lot going on here. One is I just want to throw out the fact that Firefox 3 release candidate 1 is available. My understanding is that the final version of Firefox 3 will be out within a month. This one is feature complete. It's got the final UI. You know, Firefox is obviously good stuff. So if you haven't looked at it, if you're using Firefox 2, you might want to check it out, especially just to see if your any add-ons you're using are compatible, because that's going to be an issue short term until everybody gets their add-ons upgraded. You know, some Firefox 2 add-ons won't work.
That's taken longer than I thought it would.
Yeah. Well, Firefox 3 is taking longer
than
I would think. You know, it's funny. Companies like Mozilla, you think of as fast moving and small and all this stuff. But, you know, it's been over a year and a half since Firefox 2 shipped. I mean, and it's been 3.5 years since Firefox 1. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Well, and Firefox 2 was kind of the Windows ME of Firefoxes. I mean, it was not.
Yeah. I got in some trouble with those guys for being pretty upfront about that.
I know you did, and you've been vindicated utterly.
I didn't see it as much of an upgrade. I don't know.
It was worse. It was a downgrade because it was slow. It did that pre-caching thing. It had memory leaks galore, and I think Mozilla organization did not do credit to themselves. They denied it. They flamed you. I remember very much how they flamed.
What memory leaks? What memory? You know, the things using, like, you know, 2.5 gigs of RAM. What are you talking about? You know, yeah. I mean, it was like
that's not a bug. That's a feature we intended. And you know, everybody hates Firefox 2. And I think that they really mishandled
it. I don't hate it, but I would just say that, you know, Firefox is important, right? You know, we talk a lot about cloud computing here on the podcast, and I'm, you know, Google Docs and that kind of stuff. I'm very serious about this. And right now, Firefox is my interface to this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's important to me that this thing works correctly. I like it a lot better than Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
And still recommend it.
Well, as bad as Firefox 2 was, I think Firefox 3 is good. I think they should have just skipped 2.
I think Firefox 3 is good stuff.
I have to go back and check all the extensions I had installed on 2, because I basically just turned them all off. Because I've been using 3 since
I go up and down on that stuff. I mean,
you can really kill yourself by running too many extensions.
Yeah, you can. And then, unfortunately, and I've been getting a lot of crashes lately in Firefox 3, the previous version, beta 5. And I'll never know now, but I suspect it had to do with buggy add-on type stuff, because I had too much stuff in there.
Yeah. No, I 3 beta 5 was fine for me. But, you know.
So, that wasn't actually my total tip of the week.
There's more?
I want to throw this one out because it's just so interesting and it's so cool. Microsoft came out with something a week or so ago now called the Worldwide Telescope.
Yeah, this is the thing that made Scoble cry.
Yeah, I'd like to make Scoble cry sometime. But anyway, this thing is really, really cool. And, you know, it requires Windows, of course. It's a downloadable application, but it is absolutely amazing. It is awe-inspiring. It didn't make me cry. You know, I'll probably cry when this book is done. I guess we all have different levels there. But it is absolutely beautiful, to the point where I actually did call in my son, and I called in my wife, and I said, you know, you need to look at this thing. It's really
so
impressive.
What is it?
It is to outer space what something like Google Earth is to the planet. So you know how in Google Earth you say, well, I want to go to Boston, Massachusetts, and it actually spins the globe around and it zooms in, and suddenly you're looking right down at the thing. It does this for outer space. So you could be looking at a picture of Jupiter or something, and you can go through different menus and say, well, now I want to go to this particular constellation or this other planet or this star or whatever it is. And it does that same panning and zooming, but through outer space.
But Google Sky kind of does that. Is it different than Sky?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this is really impressive. You got to look at this on a Windows computer. It's just
I think beautiful. I could find one of those lying around somewhere.
You must have one somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
I think HP pre-installs it now on their
laptop. You know what? Andy Don came while we were talking and took her computer. It's out of here. It is gone. It is no longer darkening my door. Although I'm very pleased. It was spick and span. I just ran a ESET smart security on it. Not a single flaw. So I have to say, HP gets
props.
There
is nothing more beautiful than a completely clean PC.
Yeah. Until Andy Don gets
home. Except for maybe that little media center thing. I mean, the little HP media server I have.
Microsoft. Yeah. What is it called? Telescope?
Worldwide Telescope.
Worldwide Telescope. All right.
Which is, by the way, www.worldwidetelescope, all one word, .org.
Cool. .org. Oh, it's a nonprofit.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they're going to monetize this one.
It seems like there should be a law that Microsoft cannot register any .org. You are.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, they obviously they didn't come up with this on their own, so there was some scientific input, if I'm not mistaken, NASA.
So it's not all Microsoft. I get it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to try it. I'll try. I wonder if it would work in my. I mean, I have a Vista machine running right now. It's what's recording us. But I hate to put too much stuff on that machine because I want to be flawless. So maybe I can run it. Listen. It's Microsoft Worldwide Telescope.
Is that you right there?
It's pretty. And it's going away.
I can't make it stop.
Stop. Oh, it's, you know, yeah, I even closed it and it's still making noise.
Jeez.
That's interesting. Anyway, okay.
It's the appropriate music because it is awe-inspiring.
I called you Pa. Pa.
It's awe-inspiring.
Pa. Don't you have a book, Drat, Pa? I'm gonna let you go.
Yes. I'm putting it off. No, Leo, let's talk about something else.
Oh, I know that feeling. I think I built the entire Twit network as an effort not to write another book.
My wife has done that to me this week. You know, I've been milling around the kitchen. She's like, "Do you have a book to write?"
Paul Thurrott writes very regularly on his website. In fact, he's an awe-inspiring in that regard. It's a super site for Windows. It's winsupersite.com. He's also the news editor for Windows IT Pro and his new book, Windows Vista Secrets, the second edition for Service Pack 1, will be out, tear-stained edition, in...
right. A little dot of blood in every copy.
Just for you. Paul, it's been great talking to you. I look forward to talking again next week.
Yes, sir.
On Windows Weekly. See ya.